365 days a year.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duva and I, your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11 and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Olnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. Glad to see you under these circumstances of the Thomas Fire.
Well,
you've been evacuated now.
I've been evacuated.
How many days now?
It's 9 days.
Wow.
And luckily, I was evacuated to New York.
No, your accent is back.
It's back. It's safer in New York.
No, honestly, I can't say how grateful I am for the firefighters and all that they've done. They've just done such a remarkable job at, you know, really working hard to protect our lives and many of the structures that have been really put in harm's way by this fire.
It's amazing. I was watching Key News on Saturday during the wind event, and there's a stand-up, I think it was Paul Molteri, who is showing a structure burning, and it was on my street. So it really hit close to home that I should have brought more socks with me.
Yeah. Well, it's probably not your socks that your wife wants you to have.
Right. When I used to go, my wife and I used to go hiking with our kids every year, and it was a way to keep the family together when the kids lost interest in us. And we used to comment that there's a thing called trail magic, where people were friendly on the trail. They would talk to you. They would ask about you, which, coming from New York, certainly was not the usual. And we found it to be every place, that once you're on a trail, you tend to open up and not be as protected. And what I found as an evacuee at this adult refugee camp that I'm staying at, the amount of friendliness of all our neighbors, people who I've don't even, you know, nod to, are all my pals now. It's this trail magic at the hotel.
Yep.
Which is really nice. And the other thing that's nice is, and this is true not just at the hotel I'm staying at, but at many, many hotels, is that they're giving, you know, discounted rates because they do really care about the community.
Right. And, you know, they're an important part with so many people evacuated. I think I heard 13,000 people are in the mandatory evacuation area. And I think that was before they expanded it to Mission Canyon. You know, that's a lot of people needing homes.
Yeah, no, I'm going to appreciate some of these disaster things we see on TV that we don't really think touches us. But when you watch a fire blazing down the street where you live, it kind of awakens you to the risks. So I'm going to be scared to go out of my house again.
Are you going to move to the Mesa?
I'm going to move to the Mesa. By the way, speaking of the Mesa, that's where our wonderful guest comes from.
Yes, she hails from the Mesa. We are lucky to have in studio with us today, Marcia Silvers. Silvers. I thought for a minute I was having a Neil New York moment. She's an appellate lawyer, and she will be speaking with us after we do our articles.
Right. And the articles today are going to be interesting because all the articles that I have been cutting out of newspapers are in my house, which was, I don't know if they're insured. Do you think that the articles I've been saving?
I feel like that might be hard to prove for the insurance claim.
So this is really current because the only articles I have are things that appeared in today's newspaper. And one of the most interesting is an article that appeared in the New York Times about how supply-side economics actually began. And I had no idea. And let me just read you with this paragraph. The man who first put this strategy to work for rich people was Andrew Mellon.
Oh, interesting.
Andrew Mellon, who became secretary after World War I, believed that taxes should be cut for the rich, while the poor were interested in increasing education for people who did not have money. And what Mellon came up with is the idea that, he came up with the supply side argument. And, you know, everyone thinks that Laffer, who invented the Laffer curve, was the one who invented supply side. But here it was Andrew Mellon who said that if you cut taxes on the rich, you will end up increasing economic growth that will benefit everybody. And so the populist argument that Mellon, and he called it a populist argument, and the article talks about the irony, because populism at the turn of the 19th century, at the turn of the 20th century, was all about arguing for the poor people. But Mellon took a populist stance, saying that if you cut taxes on the rich, it will really help everybody. And this has been true for the entire century, where in 1971, the Republicans, we remember this with Reagan, in 1982, made the same case. And while the article says there's no empirical or economic basis for increasing wealth among the entire population by cutting taxes on the rich, the argument still holds great sway in certain circles. And he's a professor at University of California at San Diego, said that hopefully, in his view, since he doesn't believe this will work, that populism will take another leap and will result in people getting mad about what will happen over the next 2-3 years, and we'll have another wave, but this time back to the old populism of the 1870s and
1880s. I don't know if we will, though, because when you look at what happened in the 80s with Reagan and that tax cut, we didn't go back to what the tax rates were before. I think everybody, no matter where you are, likes to think lower tax rates for everybody, because for you, it means there's more money in your pocket. But I don't know if we'll see that that wave back, because we didn't truly see it with Reagan. Tax rates with Reagan were, 40%+.
Okay, I'm going to do this on memory, because that's such a good point. In the Wall Street Journal today, off the front page, I did not cut it out, talks about this very point, about how once you cut taxes, it's very hard to reverse it, because the people—
We all get used to how much money we get into our bank account,
I think. Right, and people become much more energized when they're protecting something they already have. And so you get this, in this case, the rich are going to have this sort of renewed aggressive behavior if they try to take away, some of the tax cuts are going to sunset over the next few years.
My understanding from what I've read is the sunsets are going to be on the personal side. So any tax breaks, regardless of your income bracket, will sunset, I think, in 3 years, if my memory serves me correctly. All the corporate taxes are the permanent cuts.
So let's go to the next article, which I think is an important article because both Diane and I picked it out today. And let's start with the losers. This is an article in the New York Times that talks about winners and losers for the tax bill. And some are obvious. It's taxpayers in states that have high taxes because of the elimination of the deduction on state and local taxes, people buying health insurance, because with the repeal of the individual mandate, you're going to, based upon most people who are students of this subject, believe that rates will go up, and low-income families who are not going to get much of a benefit, if at all. But the real more interesting one, I think, which is just alluded to, is a concept called starving the beast. Starving the beast was discussed back in the 70s, and it was the Republican initiative that said the way to get rid of big government is to reduce taxes in order to reduce the ability to run large government programs. And the idea that you would cut taxes so that you could then cut social services for a liberal is so shocking.
You can't even find the word. That's how shocked you are.
But Paul Ryan, immediately last week, after he seemed to have an agreement, said the next on the agenda for the Republicans is to cut entitlements. And now they're going to take the higher deficits that they're creating with lower taxes to argue that they need to cut back on entitlements. So in terms of the losers are people that benefit.
Well, and when you look at it, the article points out the elderly, which, you know, on surface, you wouldn't automatically go to. But it's pretty much anybody that's on Medicare at this point.
That's shocking. I'm on Medicare.
I'm not. Sorry, I'm just reading the article, Neil.
Okay.
No, elderly. You can put yourself in that category or not.
Now I got two things to worry about, the fire and my Medicare.
Yeah, pretty much, because a 2010 law requires that any legislation that adds to the federal deficit be paid for by spending cuts and increases in revenues or other offsets. And some cuts would be automatic, and the biggest program that will be affected is Medicare, which, you know, the health insurance for the retired folk, I'll say retired folk to make you feel better.
Right, retired folk.
Who just happened to be of Medicare age, right, in, you know, over 65. Yeah. You know, really what they're, this article points out that there could be facing up to 4% cuts, and that is by far the biggest will be Medicare that will be affected.
So,
although I should point out that the Republicans are saying that the rule will be waived and the cuts will be averted. Yeah. But that would take a bipartisan deal, and I'm not sure if that would happen.
So my final word on this is what we saw this weekend. And this weekend we saw, you know, 8,500 firemen put their lives on the line for us. Who do you think's paying for the firemen? You know, people who hate government, you know, forget about the roads, they forget about the schools, they forget about police. And here are firemen that so far the cost is $120 million. Where does that come from? It comes from the government.
I know. And, you know, I think, to be fair, we need to point out the winners, Neil. I know you don't like the tax bill, but we should talk about who's going to benefit. One thing that I think our listeners might find interesting is that this tax reform will help people pay for private schools. So currently there's a vehicle that you can save for colleges, which is called a 529 plan. And what you're able to do is put away money. So it's after tax money. So you've already paid your income tax on it. You put it away and all the growth will be tax free if used for universities or post high school education, anything that's accredited by the government for financial aid. What this is saying is that now private schools you'll be able to use this money up to $10,000 a year for tuition for private and religious schools. So people who have been saving for 529 plans or grandparents such as yourself could get some tax benefit.
When did you become a conservative? What this is going to do is further ruin public education.
Hey, I'm not putting a judgment on it.
You belong in the hotel where I'm staying.
I can't afford that hotel. I'm not putting a judgment on it. I'm just letting people know what's out there. Also, like the estate tax is going to be from $11 million exemption to $22 million. Some of our listeners that could help them.
Help them
avoid taxes. Help
their kids avoid taxes.
Yes, help their kids because they would be no longer with us.
All right. This has been very, very interesting and very scary. You've been listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
With this Thomas Fire update, I'm Richard Dugan in the AM 1290 News Center. Cal Fire, the California Highway Patrol, and other cooperating agencies that are battling the Thomas Fire are requesting that motorists avoid Highway 154 until further notice, as the Thomas Fire Unified Command is establishing base operations for firefighters and heavy equipment to the Lake Cachuma area. This has been a Thomas Fire update from the AM 1290 News Center. I'm Richard Dugan, inviting you to stay tuned to AM 1290, the News Press radio station.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native, who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act, license number 41DB0.
60-72220. California Financial Lending Law License Number 60-DB0-72528. Loan Originator NMLS Number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while 1 in 5 children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. If you'd like to ask a question, we can be reached at 564-1290.
And we're in studio today with Marcia Silvers, who was named Super Lawyers Magazine Top 50 Women Lawyers for 2017. She's an appellate lawyer, and her practice is out of Florida. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Thanks for being here with us. So tell us a little bit about how you got here. So you practice law in Florida and you live part-time in Santa Barbara.
That's correct. And, you know, if I would have told you that I was going to be doing this 10 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it myself. Right. But now that we have all these electronics, internet, nobody really has to know where you are at any time.
Right.
And in fact, now you file things in court through e-filing. You don't even have to file papers. So I really would say I only have to go back to Florida about every 3 months, 2 to 3 months now.
Great. So yeah. Tell us how you got interested in appellate. First, we should explain what appellate law actually is.
Yes. And really also explain that I do only criminal appeals.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yes. So criminal appeals are a real specialty. Unlike trials, you get the transcript of the case after the person has already been convicted. You read the transcript, and then you look for issues in the transcript to raise on appeal that would show that the person did not get a fair trial. Constitutional issues, statutory issues, or any other kind of issue that you can show that the person did not receive a fair trial.
So by the time you get the case, it's no longer a matter of whether they're guilty or not. It's a matter of whether or not they had a fair trial based by the laws that exist by the Constitution of the United States of America.
Well, that's not totally true, because when I do the appeal, if the evidence was not sufficient to convict them under the laws that we have, I can raise that as an issue. And then if the appellate court agrees with me, then they will be, in effect, found not guilty by the appeals court.
Hmm. So an appeals court can overturn a jury case?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yes. And that's really what I'm trying to do for every case, because even if they don't find that the evidence was not sufficient to convict someone, if they reverse the case for a procedural error of some sort, the person will still get a new trial, they'll be back to square one, and they will not be a convict.
Oh, so if you find something on a procedural issue,
yes,
the convicted party would have to go to trial again. So
yes,
the prosecutor would re-prosecute with a whole new trial, a whole new jury, whole new...
Very often that happens, and then also sometimes you can work it out, since they've already usually spent some time in jail, that the prosecutors will offer something like time served. Because as time goes by, frequently prosecutors lose interest in that case. They've moved on. They have a whole pile of new cases on their desk. They don't want this old case anymore. And so frequently the person will not even need to go to trial again.
So this is a very specialized niche. How did you get here? What's your history? Are you from Florida originally?
Yes, I was born in Florida. I went to the University of Miami School of Law, and I graduated with honors. But while I was there, I had to put myself through law school. My parents told me they had four children, that they would support everybody through college, but if anybody wanted to do anything else, you'd have to pay for it yourself. And so I was kind of poor, I'm not not going to lie, and I needed a job when I was in law school. So a friend of mine worked for a criminal appellate lawyer, and she said, they need somebody, and do you want to come? And so that's really how I fell into it. After I did it, I was exposed to other areas of law in law school, but I fell in love with criminal law.
Hmm. When I lived in New York, I had a couple of friends who were.
Where's this story going?
No, it's safe.
We're criminals.
It's safe. Actually, I do have a funny story. A friend of mine who was a criminal lawyer introduced me to a friend of his and said, "You'll like this guy." And I met him, and I said, "Oh, is." We're old friends. The guy said, yeah, are you a client? And I said, no, why? You? He said, yeah. In fact, I'm under house arrest now. But anyway, the question I want to ask is, I had these friends, and they're all very tough guys, macho, but when they lost a case, they were devastated. There was an emotional component you don't see in civil litigation. Mm-hmm. As an appellate lawyer, do you have that same emotional attachment to the case?
I feel like one of the things that differentiates me from many lawyers is that I try to treat each client like they're a member of the family, because there's so much at risk here. Many of them are looking at their entire lives spending in prison, or I've had also people that are looking at the death penalty and have been given the death penalty. So, yes, I am devastated if I lose. I'm very competitive, too, and I just don't like to lose. Yes.
And you, in your death penalty cases, did you ever save anybody? Or
yes,
I don't know if that's the right word.
I've only had two death penalty cases, and each of the two I won, thank God. One recently, this summer, and then one a couple decades ago.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, Diane, should we give the telephone number in case we have convicted felons listening in the penitentiary and need a lawyer? You think that's a good idea?
they can Google her. I don't think we need to give the phone number out.
I mean, you never know. I mean, this is anyway. I think this is a good time to take a break. You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station. We'll be right back.
The Foundation for Santa Barbara City College is a nonprofit organization which supports our own Santa Barbara City College. The Foundation for Santa Barbara City College, or SBCC, funds scholarships, childcare, book grants, and other programs. Without these, many students simply would not be able to attend college. There is an amazing range of academic and vocational studies offered at City College which encourage students to find their passion and their talents. As a donor to the foundation, you have the power to change lives. Please help our community college by donating to the Foundation for SBCC. Call 730-4401 or visit us at sbccfoundation.org to find out how you can help. That's 730-4401 or sbccfoundation.org.
Rich is just a really, really, really good guy. The term good egg isn't enough to describe him. He's also certified organic and free range. Rich puts the cap back on everything. The toothpaste, the olive oil, the shampoo, everything. He lets his 10-year-old nephew beat him at virtual tennis, even though he can straight up slay his 10-year-old nephew in virtual tennis. When the toilet paper is running low, Rich replaces the roll on the actual holder, not just on the back of the toilet. Rich is texting and driving. Rich? No. What are you doing, Rich? I was just telling everyone how great you are. Texting and driving makes good people look bad. Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So, Marcia, after you graduated from college, what really drove your passion to want to pursue law as a vocation?
Well, I think I was inspired a lot by actually TV characters, women TV characters that I had seen growing up. And starting with Mary Tyler Moore, who wasn't really a lawyer, but she was really the first happy feminist character on television that made me realize that I could grow up, be a working woman, and actually have fun doing it. And then there weren't a lot of really women lawyers on television for a long time. But then along came Ally McBeal, and I loved that show. I loved that she was still feminine and still cute, but really cared about her clients and seemed to have fun. And I've always loved writing, so I was a journalism major. So I thought this would be a great way to do something involving writing, help people, and hopefully have fun.
And so you've worked with some pretty high-profile attorneys.
Yes, I was very fortunate to start out with some very high-profile lawyers as mentors in my life.
And so what would you say, because you're the sole attorney.
Yes, I'm a sole practitioner.
Sole practitioner. Mm-hmm. So what would you say you learned from those big law firms that helped make you mm-hmm. make that decision to break off on your own and really
– right.
Create the life that you want, because that's right. What so many of us want. You go into business for yourself so that though it's the extra stress,
yes.
It also allows you to, you know, be bi-coastal and do a
right.
lot of things that working right. in a big firm wouldn't allow you to.
Right. And I think it wouldn't work for everybody. You actually have to have built up a certain reputation and have a pretty good internet website. So that when people find you, they don't necessarily even need to meet you anymore because you built yourself up so much in your career that that has been very helpful for me in being able to do what I'm doing and working from Santa Barbara, where I love it.
And what made you make that decision to go out on your own?
Really, the reason I went out on my own was because I had children, and I was finding that I was just never going to be able to have any balance in my life if I didn't go out on my own. I came in one day, and we got a new racketeering case in the firm, and I was told that I was going to have to take like 150 depositions that year, and none of them were in Miami. So basically, I was never going to see my child. So I just made that decision right there on the spot without really having much of a plan that I was going to go out on my own. And it ended up that first year, I worked much less and I made the same amount. So it worked out.
When you go to a doctor and you have a special situation, the doctor refers you to someone that has that specialty. I would imagine when someone is convicted of a crime, the only person they know to recommend an appellate lawyer would be the attorney that represented them. But is that the case, because the person lost? I mean, you know, how does someone who's convicted find an? I mean, they're not.
Yeah, that's a great question. Is it the client that's surfing the web, or are you getting the referral through the losing attorney?
No, frequently it's the client now that's surfing the web, or Roy Black, who's a very premier attorney known nationwide, who was the person who I started out working for. His firm is mainly a trial firm, but they do get a lot of calls about appeals, and they don't really specialize in that so much. So they will refer cases to me as well. But I would say it's turning out more now to be the internet.
Now, so that's why your website has a picture of you in a bathing suit?
Is that No, I don't think it does, but...
Don't look
okay,
at me.
You haven't shaved. I know somebody made the Harvey Weinstein joke, but completely inappropriate.
Sorry. I apologize.
No, it's fine. I consider it a compliment.
I had a real question before I was so rudely interrupted. So now, in terms of the appeal process, how often do you have to do oral arguments for appeal appeal work, or is primarily it, you know, just in writing through the briefs?
I would say I have an appeal set maybe every 3 months now. Like I have one now for March 6th in Florida. So up till then, I don't really have to have an oral argument.
And so when you go before, is it usually in the appellate process a panel of judges or just one
excellent
singular judge?
Excellent question. Yes. So, a trial involves one judge. An appeal involves a panel of judges, three different judges. And so I feel that you get a much more fair outcome, I would say, than if you were with one judge. And you're more likely to win there than in a trial, I think. I mean, it depends on the jury. Sometimes you get a jury like O.J. Simpson did, where obviously his better chance to win was at the trial level. But I think that in general, appellate panels do take a really close look at what's happened to a defendant to try to make sure that they are not unjustly incarcerated.
Now, are you licensed solely in Florida or?
I'm licensed only in Florida. So that's why for state court cases, I only practice in Florida. But I can practice in federal courts anywhere in the country. Because as long as you are a member of a bar of any state, you can be a member of a bar of any federal appellate court as long as you've practiced a certain number of years and you are admitted.
And so what would be the differentiation between an appellate case that you would hear at the local or state level, then what's the next, like how does it get to the federal court system?
Okay.
Say I'm a convicted person in California and I find you on the internet and I say, gosh, I really want you to, you know, do my appeal work.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work?
Okay. So if you were convicted in federal court here in California, then I would be able to represent you here in the Ninth Circuit Federal Appeals Court. But if you were convicted in state court here in California, then I would not be able to represent you in an appellate court.
Understood. So do you find that people want to hire you and have two appellate attorneys, basically. So I'd hire a California one, and you would kind of be the consultant. Can you do that in the law profession?
I'm not sure I understood that question.
So, like, could I hire an appeals attorney who's licensed in the state of California and also hire you to work with that person?
Yes. Yes, you could do that.
You could do that.
The traditional criminal bar, from my recollection, was very male-oriented. Is that true of the appellate division, the appellate practice also? Are there more women?
More women in the appellate practice. And I think that is partially because it's better suited for women that have children to be an appellate lawyer. Because if you're doing a trial, it could go on a month sometimes.
And you have to live, sleep, and
yes,
breathe it.
Exactly. So 24/7, you're doing that trial. But if you're doing an appeal, you can read the transcript while your children are having a nap. I mean, it's just much easier.
So do you think that in the appeals system, it's you're more able to have better work-life balance?
Definitely, yes. And that's the reason I went into it, because I have done criminal trials and I enjoyed it, but I realized it was never going to work for me if I ever wanted to see my children
right.
for very long. Yeah.
And probably that's a big reason why, you know, law schools at this point are 50-50 male women, but practicing still it's not 50-50. There are many more men practicing law than women at this point in time.
And I would say there are more men trial lawyers still. Yes.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back. We'll be right back.
on the next episode of Recipes for Disaster.
So we've got our neighbor Paul coming over tonight for a barbecue, which is why I prepared a delicious lemon rosemary steak marinade from my special collection of old family recipes. To make sure the steaks are extra, extra, extra tender, I left them marinating out on the counter overnight, just like Nana used to.
Maria may mean well, but without food safety, it never ends well. Always thaw or marinate foods in the refrigerator at 40 degrees Fahrenheit or below, or you could make your friends and family really sick. Maria's neighbor Paul didn't think twice about the steak he ate until he was presenting his company's financial forecast to the board. That's when a sudden bout of food poisoning made it explicitly clear that profits weren't the only thing on the rise. Watch Recipes for Disaster at foodsafety.gov. You'll learn the right steps as Maria does everything wrong. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And if you're just joining us, we have Marcia Silvers, who is a criminal appellate lawyer, in studio with us today. Thanks for being here. And so, you know, as you grow up and you're watching all the attorney shows, and they're always criminally oriented, and that's how a lot of people get excited about the law. How difficult do you find it is to advocate for a client who you actually think is really guilty?
Believe it or not, I don't find it difficult at all. Because when you're in law school, they teach you that we have a legal system in place and that it only works if both sides represent their clients zealously. And if you don't, then it's not going to work. So I always feel like what I'm doing is really enforcing our rights, because if lawyers aren't around to enforce our rights, they're really just hypotheticals. So I don't have any problem whatsoever representing anyone who's accused of a crime and making sure that they get a fair trial.
And so with that said, how do you feel the current administration is in terms of have you seen a sea of change in terms of impacting clients' ability to appeal?
I saw a nice shift when we had Obama as president. He appointed quite a few really good federal district court and appellate court judges. And I noticed that the judges were giving much more fair trials than previously. And now I notice there's a shift with our current president, and he's unfortunately appointing people who don't really care at all, about enforcing the right to a fair trial. And I'm very concerned because he has appointed so many federal criminal appellate judges now that his legacy, this is going to be his biggest legacy.
Yeah, I think we have 14 now that the current administration has appointed.
Right.
What'd you think of that guy who was nominated to be a district judge last week who couldn't answer basic legal questions?
I was horrified. And that's not what the system is supposed to do. We're not supposed to be all about politics when we appoint judges. But unfortunately, that's what it's become.
Yes.
So if somebody, I understand about the adversarial relationship must be maintained in a balanced way, so you have to defend someone who's guilty. But when someone tells you they're guilty and you're a defense attorney, are you breaking any rules by, in a sense, perjuring perjury by telling them that they're innocent? I mean, how do you deal with the idea of knowing that if you put him on the stand, knowing that he is telling something that's not true?
Well, that would be a bar violation. Mm-hmm. So you cannot put someone on the stand and have them testify that they're innocent if you know they are not innocent. And that would be actually a disbarrable offense.
Okay. So that's interesting. Yeah. Then one of the things that if someone knows that on a jury, they would say maybe she's not putting him on the stand because
she knows. That's one of the major questions that the attorneys ask themselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If we don't put him on the stand, he looks guilty. But if we put him on the stand, he'll have to say he is guilty.
And the jury is always instructed not to consider the fact that a defendant hasn't testified, but everyone knows they do.
So,
do you ever do that with clients, though, in the appellate world? Do you, with the oral arguments in front of the panel of judges, mm-hmm. you don't ever bring your client in with you, do you?
No, it's strictly me and the judges. In fact, the clients don't usually even attend the oral arguments. Many times because they're in jail.
Right.
And the other side, the prosecution side. At the hearing, let's assume this is a 7-8-year-old case. The prosecutor may have, be now at a big law firm.
Right.
Does the prosecutor who represents the state less aggressive at an appeal because they don't have an emotional or otherwise
because they weren't the trial attorney?
Yeah, I mean, I
would say they're definitely easier for me to deal with. I'm more rational about the cases when I speak to them, but they want to win just as bad as the trial lawyers do.
So sometimes
they do twist the facts in the briefs, and I have to point it out. And they twist the facts when they do the oral arguments because they want to win so badly.
Okay, so how do you get paid? The convicted felon usually by that time has no money. Do they have money?
It depends on who they are and what they've done in their life. Sometimes they do have money themselves. Sometimes their family, very often their family has money. And that's usually the case for 90% of my clients, I would say.
Okay. And is there a situation like with regular, with trial lawyers where you have to do free work as part of your portfolio? Do you get assigned cases that you have to do for pro bono?
That's a good question. You're not required to do pro bono work, but I do. Pro bono work, and I probably have at least 3 or 4 pro bono cases right now. And a lot of times I'll have cases, and if I've lost the case, I will continue to represent that person because I don't feel that maybe their sentence was equitable or something else motivates me, and they've run out of money, and I'll just continue to work on the case.
I always thought you were a nice person.
So how often is it a change of attorney from the trial? Like, do the states have trial attorneys in the prosecution and appellate attorneys within the – so it's never the same person?
The same person.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's always trial prosecutors do one thing, trials, and appellate prosecutors do only appeals. Mm-hmm.
So what's your proudest moment? What's the biggest win in terms of emotional win?
Well, I've had a few, and it's hard, a few really proud moments. I would say it's one that you wouldn't necessarily think would be my proudest moment, but it was an African-American man who was educated and worked for an airlines in Miami, and he was accused of taking luggage off of the normal path in customs so that it could be diverted to a drug dealer. And the only evidence that they had against him were people who were very high up in the drug conspiracy who negotiated sweetheart deals to testify against this little guy down at the very bottom of the totem pole. And so, for example, the kingpin was going to do 5 years if he would come on and say, my guy was guilty. And so he went to trial, and he lost. And the kingpin got 5 years, and he got 30 years. And that happens very often in our system because
the
government wants to get the most information they can, so they have no real motivation to talk to somebody who, say, is a courier of drugs. They want to talk to the kingpin and get as many people as they can. So they offer that they want to give them the deals, and then the person who's really just a nobody ends up coming out the worst. And it's one of the things about the system that really irks me. And I was able to win his appeal. And I actually got him out of jail, and he was only in there for like a year. And to this day, every year he comes back and thanks me. His kids thank me, and that really was my proudest moment.
You know, it's interesting. We're watching this investigation of the Russian Trump relationship, and everyone talks about how prosecutors start at the bottom and work their way up. But what you're telling us is very interesting. In most, you know, standard cases, is the opposite. Just to keep the umbrella wide.
Right.
So they can say they convicted 30 people rather than just one.
Right. Exactly. And it, you can talk to any federal judge or state court judge, and they'll tell you they're horrified because they see it all the time. But, of course, no one does anything about it because prosecutors have a great amount of discretion.
But and the judges have to have these mandatory sentences. Is that the reason?
And that's, yes, that's the problem, too, that we have these mandatory sentences, which has now led to mass incarceration in our country. Our country now has 2.3 million people incarcerated. One out of every 100 people is incarcerated, and one out of every 32 people is either on parole or probation,
Wow.
is ridiculous. But we continue to proceed at this rate.
So that was your most gratifying. Is there one that you could talk about that was your most disappointing?
There is one that was my most disappointing, and that involved someone. His name was Todd Derry. I don't mind saying his last name. He was in his 20s. He went fishing with his best friend, and they were both drinking a lot of beer. They both got very drunk, and they ended up going to a gas station after they were done fishing to fill up the tank, and Todd's friend Garrett didn't want to go with Todd to see Todd's girlfriend. They got in a big fight. They were drunk. And you can see on the video at the gas station that Garrett is chasing Todd, who was much smaller, around the gas station. Todd runs and gets in his truck, and Garrett runs after him and jumps in as he's driving off. So it clearly appears on the videotape that Todd is the one who's being attacked. Next thing you know, Todd shows up at a Walmart, and he's screaming that Garrett has been shot. And call 911, and Garrett has, in fact, been shot in the head. And he saves his life by going to the Walmart. Now, Garrett had been shot in the head. So he had some minor brain damage, and he ended up testifying that Todd, when they were in the car, Todd pulled out a pistol from under his seat and pointed the pistol directly at him where he was sitting in the passenger seat and shot him in the forehead on purpose. And Todd was convicted, and they have minimum mandatory sentencing for that because it was with a firearm, so he got 25 years minimum mandatory. They hired me after he had lost his appeal to see if there was an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So I came in, and I got to look at the prosecutor's file because at that point it was part of the public records. And I was able to find in the prosecutor's file that Garrett, the alleged victim, had said while he was in the hospital exactly what Todd said happened, which was that there was a struggle over the gun, but that it accidentally went off, ricocheted from the top of the roof strut, and then hit him in the head. And so that had never been disclosed to the defense. The prosecutor suppressed that. And I was horrified, and I brought it up as an ineffective assistance of counsel prosecutorial misconduct claim, but also an ineffective assistance of counsel because the lawyer never really had an expert examine the truck, and if he had, he would have seen the ricochet marks. So I thought this was a dead bang winner. I litigated it, and the judge denied him a new trial, saying that the victim, when he made that statement, was in the hospital, and he probably wasn't in his right mind. And that's how they got around giving him a new trial, and he's still in jail.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah. That's tough.
You're listening. So, we need to have to take a break
because
of that story. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
With this Thomas Fire update, I'm Richard Dugan in the AM 1290 News Center. All mandatory evacuation orders that were issued this weekend remain in effect, with the exception that residents living in all areas from Toro Canyon west to Olive Mill Road and from Highway 101 north to State Route 192 are now permitted to return to their neighborhoods and homes. This has been a Thomas Fire update from the AM 1290 News Center. I'm Richard Dugan, inviting you to stay tuned. AM 1290, the News Press radio station.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act, license number 41DB07222. California Financial Lending Law License Number 60DB072528. Loan Originator NMLS Number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937.
So, Marcia, oh, sorry. we don't have much time. I'm cutting you off. Sorry. I have a question. So, before the break, you know, you told us that story that I was riveted with. So, how do you handle the emotional side when you know that you have a person's fate in your hands?
I think it's kind of like a surgeon who has to go in and do open heart surgery. You can't really think that much about it as a person. That you care about them, but you really just have to concentrate on doing your job. And that's what I do.
And so in terms of when you evaluate taking a case, is part of it, do you think that they deserve to go to jail or not? Does that ever come into your process? How do you evaluate that case?
No, I don't really think about that when I take a case. I just, if they want to hire me, I'm willing to take the case. The only cases that I don't do are child pedophile cases, simply because I'm a mom and I just don't think that I could do a good job on those cases. But other than that, any other case I would take.
Well, thank you so much, Marcia. And for those listeners, if you go on Marcia Silva's website, you'll see stuff we didn't discuss where she's really an award-winning attorney that has had many, many, many successful cases. We're so lucky to have you here and in our community. And for everyone out there, we wish you nothing but the best with this fire. And hopefully next week I'll be back home. You've been listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll see you next week.